Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Cochran, Judge Siegel, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Please be seated. Good morning.
Good morning.
And welcome to this January 29 panel of the Court of Appeals. We have six cases on our schedule today, four of which will be orally heard, two non-oral, and three of the non-oral cases are on interactive television. But this is our only live presentation today. Our first case is Bolter versus is it Steinert? Am I pronouncing that right?
Steinert.
Counsel, each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel, which you can use for rebuttal if you choose to do so. The timing restrictions are indicated in the light and the clock built into the podium, which, by the way, you can elevate or lower to your height. There's a button in the front for your convenience. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument, because we do keep track of who's making which argument in the audio recording of things. Counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready to proceed, you have the floor.
Thank you.
If it please the court and counsel, good morning. My name is Peter Lind, and I represent the appellant in this case. I would submit to the court that this is a straightforward, simple case that went down a rabbit hole. When the case began, the parties recognized that the legal issue, which had not been decided by an appellate court in Minnesota, was whether or not strict compliance was applicable to the notice statute. In the case were two experts, one for the plaintiff and one for the defendant, two experienced real estate attorneys that issued long, detailed opinions about what they thought about that legal issue. Now, the trial court, Judge Janisch, did a very good job, a thorough job, a complete job in taking all of this information, analyzing it, and coming to conclusions. One of the conclusions she came to was that this court would have found strict compliance was applicable and therefore would have found that the mortgage foreclosure was void and invalid, and that ultimately would have returned the property to my client.
Now, you say found, you mean she held, right? I mean, just because you have experts that are commenting about what this court would have done, ultimately that's a question of law that we would determine.
Well, you know, that is an issue, but it's a side issue, I believe, Your Honor. The appellate court in Minnesota has not decided directly on point whether or not that is an issue to be decided by the court or an issue to be decided by another trier of fact, a jury. That issue being when the question is, what would the Court of Appeals have done?
It would seem to be an odd thing to present to a jury, wouldn't it, as a matter of fact? How would a jury know how to analyze the legal issues? I mean, if you have two experts that offer up what the court would do and they just happen to be wrong, how would a jury be in a position to decide that issue?
Well, I think a jury, like in other scientific or mechanical or complicated cases where experts are involved in testifying and educating the jury about things, I think this is no different.
Well, it's a little different because we're not mathematicians or scientists. We're judges who decide what the law is. And if we're deciding what the law is, not just what the law is, but what this court would have said about what the law is, in a, if had the case been handled differently, it seems to me that would be an odd thing to remove from this court and its de novo review of this question. Seems to me strange.
Perhaps. But that is not an issue in this appeal. What is whether or not the trial court erred in, after determining strict compliance was applicable, whether she erred in then looking at another issue an issue that I submit to, I submitted to her and I submit to this court that was not in the underlying case. And that issue was whether or not this property was owner-occupied single-family dwelling.
So how would that work? I'm trying to say, if playing back the clock, looking into the into the mirror and what would have happened, let's assume that you are correct, and this court would have said, well, that issue wasn't presented at summary judgment, so summary judgment was improperly granted, so we're reversing summary judgment. The case then would go back to the district court, and at some point, the legal issue could have been, and we can presume, would have been raised because your client would have had the obligation to have established that the statute applied in order for your established, in order for your client to prevail in the quiet title action. Am I correct about that?
You are, but I would say it a different way, which is my client in the underlying action submitted his case upon that statute and other issues that are not involved here. And the bank did not respond to that by saying something as simple as, no, it does not apply, because this is not owner-occupied single-family dwelling. The bank,
in you're my not arguing now that your client, if I'm not mistaken, maybe I'm mistaking the argument, the status of the litigation now. You're not saying that your client would have prevailed at summary judgment in your client's summary judgment motion, but that the district court, but that your client would have prevailed in getting summary judgment in favor of your opponent reversed. And those are two different things. Am I correct that that's the status?
Well, let me preface it with this observation, which is we're all guessing what would have happened because the lawyer failed to get the case here for the Court of Appeals to look at it.
Well, there was a notice of, okay, so that was at the briefing stage.
Right.
Wasn't there a notice of appeal filed?
Oh, yeah. The appeal was all done, but his malpractice.
Right, but was the did the notice include, was it just that the district court erred in granting summary judgment, or that the district court, there were cross motions for summary judgment, if I recall, in the underlying action, or am I wrong about that? Was there only
I'm
one?
I'm not sure. I don't believe Bolter brought a motion for summary
judgment.
Okay,
so if that's the case, it's even more clear that if what your client, if what the lawyer failed to do was to file a brief in support of a notice of appeal challenging only summary judgment, then your client would have prevailed only to get summary judgment reversed, where the then your client would have had the burden to establish that the statute does apply.
And I would submit to the court that he established that in the underlying case by asserting the application of that statute, number one, and number two, the bank doing nothing about it.
Well, the trial hadn't occurred yet. So the bank could have done something during the trial. The bank could have said, well, in order to establish your case, you've got to show that the statute applies. I mean, don't we assume that at a trial that your client would have had to meet every element of the claim, quiet title claim?
I agree.
Isn't that one of the elements that you'd have to establish?
I agree. And he would have met it by saying this statute is applicable. The Court of Appeals has now reversed on strict compliance. Therefore, I prevail and this house should be returned to me. The bank then presumably would stand up and say, oh no, we're going to challenge the application of the statute. And the attorney for Bolter would have said, but you have already conceded it, bank.
Why do you think that's so? That's my problem with your argument. Why would a failure to raise a challenge at summary judgment necessarily concede that challenge for later litigation? Why would that be? Is there any case law that says it's waived if the issue is never presented or decided by the court?
Well, if for example, if there is a statute of limitation defense and the defendant never raises it, it's not applicable, even though, had it been raised, it would be applicable.
Well, right, but if it's not raised at summary judgment, you're saying it can't be raised later?
I would submit that in this particular case, it's either waived or the bank decided it was not applicable, or there was no evidence to support it. The first request for admission that the attorney did in the underlying case was to ask the bank about owner-occupied single-family dwelling. And the bank said, admits the 2005 mortgage, which constitutes security for repayment of loans made by defendant to plaintiff, includes several parcels, one of which was improved by an owner-occupied single-family dwelling.
It was improved by it. I mean, if I had a commercial property with 15 commercial tenants in it, I might improve the property by adding a single-family home on it, but that doesn't necessarily meet the statutory requirement, at least the way the district court interpreted the statute, which is it is, the real estate is an owner-occupied single-family residence.
But this question is asked in the context of this case, not a general proposition. And I would submit, as I argued to the trial court, that this issue is over. It not in the underlying case, and to the extent it is, it's given up.
But and Counselor, whether in the request for admissions, the bank didn't admit that that was the sole dwelling on that parcel. I mean, you're reading a lot into that request for admissions. It just says improved by on one of the parcels. It doesn't say, and there are no other dwelling units on this parcel. Because that's what you're asking us to assume, correct?
Right, and in my brief, I submitted the appraisal that was done by the defense with pictures of the property and description of the property. And the only thing on this plot of land is a three-bedroom house with one bathroom, two garages, and a little guest cabin. So there's nothing else on this property.
When you say guest cabin, does the guest cabin have a bathroom?
No.
Wasn't the guest cabin rented out? Didn't deposition testimony establish that?
It did establish that. It was rented out to a friend, a co-worker, that lived there.
So then how would that parcel with an owner-occupied home and a guest cabin constitute real estate? Under the language of the statute, it says if the real estate is an owner-occupied single-family dwelling.
Well,
given that you have two structures and one is being rented out.
But if you have, I mean, is it any different from having an in-law living in the basement or in the back? Or
well, it would be different because you have a separate structure and that separate structure is being rented out. It's not an owner-occupied single-family dwelling. And being the operative word that I think the district court was focused on.
I don't think the people in Aiken County consider guest cabin to be a development or a multi.
But here, aren't we required to look at the plain language of the statute?
Yes, you are. I agree with that. And I would submit in looking at the plain language, looking at the words of the statute, it fits the description given by the appraiser of the property, which is it's a single-family dwelling, three bedrooms, one bathroom for a family, a single family. It's not a duplex. It's not a fourplex. And the guest cabin, does that add or detract from it? I don't think it has any bearing on it.
Is it a dwelling?
It's a dwelling. It's a guest cabin for people, obviously, to be guests.
The tough thing is, sir, the statute is worded differently from most of real estate. It doesn't include the usual verbiage, which is, I mean, it says the real estate is a dwelling. I mean, usually the real estate includes buildings, and it includes everything on the land. But in this case, the statute, we have to treat the statute as we get it. And the statute refers to what is real estate, and in this case, what is real estate is the structure.
I understand that, Your Honor. And on that point, then perhaps it goes to this issue, which is is the trial court correct in deciding as a matter of law that this property, as described, the four buildings on that land, is it not owner-occupied, not single-family dwelling? And in looking at the court's decision, it's very brief in its analysis. I submitted in my brief to the court two cases close to off point having something to do with this, but I couldn't find anything in Minnesota that defined what these terms mean in conjunction with a case. And so the court, I would submit, took an extra step that she shouldn't have in deciding as a matter of law, rather than, because I would have accepted this, rather than saying that's a triable issue. We're going to have to come up with an instruction.
Did you present to the district court material facts that are an issue, and if so, which ones on that question?
I submitted to the court, first of all, my client in his deposition provided his own testimony, and then I submitted to the court affidavit from him talking about that subject of when he was in town and when he was living there and who was living there.
But what's the fact dispute? I mean, there's no dispute that somebody other than a family member was in that other place living there and paying rent.
Right.
So what's the fact dispute?
You're right. You're right on that. The fact dispute is when you look at the property and you know who was living there and who was occupying it, does that fit the definition of single-family dwelling
owner-occupied? So that's a question of law, isn't it? Aren't we just applying the law to that question?
Oh, I don't think that is at all. I think that's a question of fact. Because I think that's a question of fact. I don't think
we're talking about interpreting the statute.
How is it a question of fact?
Well, the question to the jury is, is the question of, is this owner occupied, yes or no? Is this a single family dwelling? And that's where the instruction comes into play to the jury, which is, jurors, this is a definition of single family dwelling.
Thank you, Mr. Lind. I think your time has expired, but you will have an additional 5 minutes of rebuttal to cover anything that our questions prevented you from getting to.
No problem. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court and counsel, my name is Corinne Ivansa, and I represent the respondent and cross-appellant, Jeremy Steinert. I'll start with the subject of appellant's appeal, and then I'll move on to the issue in the cross-appeal. A plaintiff's burden in a legal malpractice case is to show that he would have been successful in the underlying case, but for the negligence. That's the Blue Water case.
What does that mean? Does it mean successful at summary judgment, or successful on appeal, or successful in the end?
It means successful in the whole case. So in this particular case, appellant only wants us to look at what the Court of Appeals would have done. That's not at issue in this appeal. We've conceded for the purposes of the appeal that Judge Janisch was correct in stating that the Court of Appeals would have taken issue with the fact that the district court had not considered the application of 5804B. And we've also conceded that it would have had to been remanded to the district court because it hadn't been considered.
Well, not just remanded. We would agree, wouldn't you, that we would have reversed summary judgment?
Correct. Reverse the grant of summary judgment in the underlying case and remanded it to the district court for further proceedings. Okay? So that's not at issue here. Then the question is, we need to determine what would have happened at the district court.
Appellant argues that if the Court of Appeals reversed, that would have had the effect of voiding the foreclosure and returning the homestead to appellant.
That's just not possible because of the procedural posture of the underlying case. Judgment in the homeowner's favor was never at issue at all, because the issue in the underlying district court case was defendant's motion for summary judgment. That was what was appealed. The Court of Appeals can't do anything other than reverse the grant of summary judgment and remand. If there were facts in the record that could have enabled a finding in appellant's favor at that point, I guess it's possible that the Court of Appeals could have directed that judgment be entered, but there were not facts in the record at the Court of Appeals level which established the application of 580.04b. So it would have had to be remanded. And so then what happens back at the district court? How do we figure out how to see if that was successful? And the standard that we look to is found in the Rouse case. And that is, if the appellant could not have survived a motion for summary judgment on whatever particular issue at the district court, then the appellant can't survive a motion for summary judgment on the same issue in the legal malpractice case. And that makes sense. That's the case within the case. So the issue is whether parcel 6 was one where the 580.04b notice had to be given. And the answer is it was not, because 580.04b applies only if the real estate is an owner-occupied single family dwelling. Under the plain language of the statute, that's all the further you have to look. The real estate has to be such a dwelling, not just include such a dwelling.
At what point? Usually when you think about real estate law, it's the you don't look at who's living. If you're going to define what is a single family unit, you look at the property. You don't necessarily look at who's in the property, except for the owner-occupied part. But as far as the single-family dwelling, isn't that a legal term of art?
Is it a legal term of art? I mean, I don't know. One interesting thing that you can look at in that regard is the following section of the statute, 580.041. That section requires a different type of notice in a foreclosure by advertisement. And that section states that it applies to property, quote, consisting of 1 to 4 family dwelling units, one of which the owner occupies. And so the legislature, for whatever reason, and it doesn't matter what reason it is, decided in the following section of the statute to be inclusive in its wording, but in this section, 580.04b decided to be exclusive. So I think that you don't have to look past the plain language.
Let's assume this was all that was on the property was a single residence, a four-bedroom residence, one of the bedrooms being a mother-in-law apartment arrangement, occupied by a mother-in-law. Does the statute apply?
I think there's an argument that it does not, because there's an additional dwelling unit on the property.
There's an additional dwelling unit if there's a mother-in-law apartment within the single-family home?
Yes.
Is there any other place where you would define this as a multi-family home simply because there's a mother-in-law apartment within it? Any place in the statutes where single-family dwelling would construe this as a multi-family dwelling under that circumstance?
I'm not sure, and I don't think, there may be some provision of tax law that applies. I'm not a tax law expert. I do legal malpractice. But in this circumstance, I think the language is clear, and we don't look past 580.
Right, but in my hypothetical circumstance, and we're not looking past 580, what would the answer be?
I'm sorry, I've lost the question.
My hypothetical, what would the answer be? How would this be a single-family dwelling if it had a mother-in-law apartment built into it?
I don't believe so, because there's another dwelling unit there. That would be two dwelling units, meaning that the real estate would not be an owner-occupied single-family dwelling exclusively.
Okay, let's assume facts are slightly different. It's just a regular four-bedroom home, one of the rooms being rented out to a family friend. Single family dwelling?
Yes.
Okay, so in that case, so it's a single family dwelling in that case, even though it's being rented out in part.
I think it's different to rent out a bedroom than it is to rent out another unit.
Well, what if the other unit doesn't have a bathroom, doesn't have a kitchen? It's just a cabin.
Well, I don't think there's, and I don't have the appraisal in front of me, but I'm nearly certain that the cabin, the guest cabin on this particular property, did have a bathroom and a kitchen.
Oh, I thought my understanding was that it did not. So it does. Do we know from the record?
It is in the appraisal. Okay. Yeah. So I don't know, but I assume so because they were renting it and using it as their home, the tenants were. So
let's talk about we've talked about single family dwelling. Let's talk about is. If the real estate is an owner occupied single family dwelling, let's assume instead of a separate cabin, you had the owner built a four car detached garage and the owner was renting out those garage stalls to various individuals commercially to store their boat. Is the property then an owner-occupied single-family dwelling? I'm trying to get a sense of the focus of the analysis. Should it be on how the other property is being used, or is it more is this a term applied as it usually is? We're looking at single-family dwelling versus multifamily dwelling. What is the term? How is the term of art usually applied in real estate? So going back to my hypothetical, is that a single-family, an owner-occupied single-family dwelling?
I think you could argue that it is in that circumstance. The commercial, the renting out of the commercial space might create some question there.
And that gets to Mr. Lin's, I think. The tension I have between your approach and his is this: at some point, does this become a question for a jury?
I don't think so, because it's the bare application of the statute to undisputed facts.
You're saying that so even if it's a close call?
Yes.
You don't seem too confident in that.
I have 4.5 minutes left, and I do have an entire separate cross appeal that I would like to move on to, if that's all right.
I have one further question.
Yes.
Going back to that language, is it a close call in this case? It appears the facts are undisputed.
The facts are undisputed that this other dwelling was being rented out monthly to two tenants. It had a separate address, and it had a separate mailbox. They'd been there for years. I mean, under these facts, I don't think it is a close call as to the application of the statute. So since the undisputed facts do not support the application of 5804B, appellant could not have prevailed in the underlying quiet title action. Therefore, the district court properly granted summary judgment to respondent.
Before you move on to your next issue, you discuss Mr. Lin's waiver argument that the issue wasn't presented at summary judgment. The issue, therefore, could not be presented in the subsequent action after reversal and remand?
I don't think there's any basis for the argument. And the district court actually specifically asked Mr. Lin about this in oral argument and asked him to find a case that says that. I mean, the procedural posture would have been a reverse of the grant of the motion for summary judgment. And then you try the issue, you go back and you try the actual issues. They don't have to raise every triable issue in their motion for summary judgment. You don't raise every triable issue in the motion for summary judgment. You only raise those ones you think you can win on summary judgment. So I don't think there's any basis for a waiver argument. And as to the request for admissions, I think the first request for admission speaks to what the property was improved by at the time the mortgage was placed on it. And then the bank goes on to deny all of the other requests in terms of whether he was living there. And there is no request that speaks directly to the issue of whether the property is a single family owner occupied dwelling. So I don't think it was waived and I don't think it was admitted. The district court also erred in declining to grant respondents' motion for summary judgment on the issue of the lack of damages. So in this case, what appellant requests in terms of damages is the value of Parcel 6, okay? So since we don't have Parcel 6 to give appellant, so we have to determine what Parcel 6 was worth. And in order to do that, we've got to pick a date. When is the earliest date when appellant would have gotten the parcel back? And we've given appellant all benefit of the doubt to pick the date of February 1st of 2016, the earliest date that the district court could have awarded judgment in appellant's favor. And that date has not been contested by appellant as a part of this appeal. On that date, it's undisputed that there was about $745,000 in encumbrances that would have applied to appellant's interest. Okay, of that amount, approximately $199,000 was a result of the three bank mortgages. Now, the important point here is that if the foreclosure were to stand as it did, that $199,000 is wiped away. Those mortgages are gone. If the mortgage foreclosure gets voided, they come back. So the result of voiding the mortgage foreclosure in the underlying case, as appellant says should have happened had it been heard on the merits, is that appellant receives title to a property worth $185,000 while also receiving $199,000 in debt at the same time.
Is the fair market value dispute such that there's a tribal issue of fact on this question?
It is not. And for the reasons, this is directly on point with the H.P. Drawer case and also with the unpublished opinion of Gray v. Conrad. H.P. Drawer requires that foundation be laid in order for an owner to opine on the market value of the property. No foundation was laid here. In the Gray v. Conrad case, which is unpublished but instructive, that case found that the owner had provided only their subjective opinion because they stated what the property was worth to them. And if you look at appellant's testimony, which is found on document 32, page 146 of his testimony, is where he talks about what he thinks the value is. And I said, question, why do you think it's worth so much more than the realtor does? Answer, to me it is. I don't care what the realtor says, to me it's worth a lot more than that. I did all the work, I did all the sweat, I put all the stuff into it, not her. He's talking about his subjective opinion. So there's no foundation.
And you're saying his subjective opinion can't be a basis for a jury finding in his favor?
That's correct. Yes, because it's not probative of the objective market value of the property. So it doesn't create a fact dispute. The only evidence in the record is that it's worth $185,000.
Thank you, Ms. Avanza. Your time has also expired. And we'll turn to Mr. Lynn. Any rebuttal?
Thank you. For context, I would submit that the analysis done by the two experts, neither one of whom looked at the single family dwelling issue. And I would submit to the court that they didn't, because everything they looked at in the underlying case didn't address that, didn't raise it, was not concerned about it. These are two experienced real estate attorneys that would know an issue when it appears to them. Neither one of them looked at this issue. Further, I would submit that the whole body of evidence in this case and all of the filings, there is nothing in there that indicates the bank was raising its hand to say, I object because this is not a single family dwelling. Finally, I would submit to the panel.
Again, your client would still have to make that basis for prevailing in an underlying case after summary judgment was denied.
I agree with that. And he would have done that by saying, here's the statute, here's my property.
And when you say, here's my property, would he have to acknowledge that the property has a bathroom, a kitchen, and an address and a mailbox separate from the other dwelling?
He would. And would the question then is, would that have made it not a single family dwelling? And I would submit to the court again that the problem here is that the district court, without a case to support that decision, taking these facts into account, declared it this way rather than that way.
I'm trying to get a sense of why would you need a case to support the proposition that when it's your client's burden to show that having two residences, two occupied by non-family members, independent of each other, even though the property is not subdivided, there's a separate dwelling place on it. Why would there need to be more for the district court to say, to decide whether this is a multiple dwelling property or a single dwelling property?
Well, as you pointed out, Your Honor, in a couple of hypotheticals, the mother-in-law, the pal that's renting a room, I mean, the question is, does that take it out of single family dwelling? And that's why I go back to the two experts and their analysis.
Well, wouldn't it if the mother-in-law's apartment had its own address and it was bifurcated to appear as a duplex? Wouldn't that necessarily, as the terms are usually used in real estate, wouldn't that become a multi-family dwelling rather than a single-family dwelling?
I suppose, Your Honor, it would depend upon how it looked. I mean, if it looked like this looks, which is a house and a guest cabin and two garages, I would say that's a single-family dwelling, owner-occupied. But if it looked like a duplex with two doors attached together or a fourplex, then it would be a multi-family unit.
That seems to be a hiccup for your case then, because here it's more than having an internal division between the two residences, like a duplex. You actually have a separate unit, separate address, separate mailbox, separate bathroom, separate kitchen. It's independent. It's more. Why isn't this more independent of the family structure than a duplex in the hypothetical?
When you look at the picture of the cabin, I don't think you imagine that a family is living in there.
Well, you don't have to imagine it here. Someone else is living in
it. Well, a guy was living in there.
Not imaginary, is he?
He didn't have a family.
Okay.
That's all I can say. So those are my final comments.
Do you agree on the question of damages, that foundation has to be laid for appellant to give an opinion as to the market value of the property?
Let me answer it this way. In the filings, answers to interrogatories, all of that stuff in the case, we've identified a real estate agent to testify to values depending upon what time period we're talking about. And then my client, who is the owner, can give his own opinion. And it's based upon real estate values up there. He's lived up there. He'll be able to testify plenty to values in McGregor. And that was not an issue. I mean, the legal issue that was raised here by respondent had to do with he's got all this debt to the property, and therefore, what's the point? Not could he testify, and is it objective, and is there a foundation for it? There is foundation for it. We never got to it.
Well, thank you. Thank you to both counsel for your written submissions and your oral argument today. Very interesting case. Amazing that it's one here in first impression, but since the statute's been around for quite a while. But thank you for your presentation. The matter is submitted, and we will issue our opinion deciding the appeal within the statute.